So my talk is mainly concerned with exhibitions of artistic and literary practices. In speaking about the work of art as a phenomenon, I am not so much guided by a formalist or historiographical approach to art, although I am guided in many ways by these two approaches, as you will probably pick up as I go on with my talk. So I want tonight to speak more about how the value and significance of a work of art emerges in respect to how its exhibition engages what we could call fields of social sensibility and sites of emotional attachment. Towards this, I was thinking about the related terms, as you would have perhaps picked up on the blurb description for the talk. I was thinking about the related terms exhibit and inhibit in respect to how exhibitions are not only about the work that is shown or read, but also how they involve a performative dimension, the engagement of an audience, or the engagement, if you like, of an audience's sensibility. We can thus play on the terms exhibit, inhibit, and inhabit, if you want, to speak of the Latin inhibitus more extensively as habitus. So habitus relates to dwelling or a social ontology in the context of which people develop capacities to fashion, appropriate, and undergo particular ways of being in the world. Part of this fashioning and undergoing involves dress and gesture, conduct and comportment. In this respect, I want to consider how viewing and listening are not so much forms of reception or not so much forms of communication, but rather constitute sites of dwelling as an extensive dimension of an exhibition. So I remind you of the title of my talk, and it has two parts. A photograph looking, and I will come to this in a moment and give some explanation of this interesting photograph here. But also the notions of documentary and performative registers in respect to practices of research on cultural production. So I've suggested that the question of their practical and conceptual relationships would have to be approached by considering their convergence or their confluence, if you like. I am inspired here by the notion that any clear division between art and science becomes fragile as the coordinators of our colloquium state in their outline. Now, intellectual inquiry, of course, is quite adept at identifying divisions, drawing distinct categories, ideal types, and then only to argue that in practice that they are not so distinct or divided. And I guess in my talk I will be doing some of this tonight. Especially as I want to show how the confluence, or what I would like to call the confluence, of performative and documentary registers is just as divergent as it is convergent. So this requires a more flowing appreciation of their relationships and taking note of how their practices embody fields of social sensibility and emotional attachment. So before I get to the photograph, which I will do so in a minute, I want to give an example from my own experience of attending a few years ago a writers' festival in Australia, in Sydney. And this was quite a big, the Sydney Writers Festival. It's an annual event and goes on for 3 or 4 days. There's many events and many different activities and book signings and launchings and talks and the usual thing, I guess. But at this particular Writers Festival, they had one event called a Multicultural Forum. So I went along, especially as two of my friends with variable Lebanese backgrounds were reading from their works. There was also besides them, an Australian with a Vietnamese background. There was another person with a Greek background, and there was also an Aboriginal Australian. When it came, it was interesting that when it came for the Australian with a Vietnamese background to read his work, for whatever reason, and I didn't really understand why, but he decided not to read his work himself, but had asked someone to read his work for him. And it was quite funny that this person that did read his work spoke in an English that was just such a high and polished English that it just sort of didn't fit in, as you would imagine, with the multicultural forum. So in listening to the culturally coded pitch and rhythm of her voice, or if you like, the performative register, rather than the referential content of what she read out, or the documentary register, I began to wonder why an Australian writer with a British background wasn't also invited to the multicultural forum. So I had the sense that ethnicity here was somehow being staged towards producing a predominating sense of Australianness that is apparently unmarked by ethnicity. So did the multicultural forum work to document multicultural writers, or did it have a performative, a curatorial effect in which multiculturalism was habilitated or habituated, if you like, as a field, as I've been saying, of social and emotional sensibility in respect to a field, as was the case of a political culture. So in performing the assigned role of multicultural performer, the so-called multicultural writers were supposed to look like ethnics, I guess, while the audience were also to play their part and look at the writers as if they were ethnics. But to what extent, I thought at the time, did we all look at each other and perhaps pretend that we weren't pretending? In this instance, it made no sense to describe ethnicity as a person's cultural background or person's cultural baggage, but rather as a social field of production, prescribing certain ways to actively look and be looked at, to speak and be heard. Now, interestingly enough, the last speaker was indeed the Aboriginal Australian, and he did this read from a poem of his called Crocodile Looking, hence the first part of the title of my talk, Photograph Looking. And listening to his poem from the beginning, I had these images. I guess I'd seen too many Tarzan films in my youth of being on a boat on a river and looking out for crocodiles that are going to come, and then maybe imagining myself launching into the water and having a fight and all this Tarzan stuff. But it became quite apparent as he went on. I don't remember the words of his poem, but what he in fact was getting at was crocodile looking at people. This was the gist of his poem, and in fact he was playing around, foregrounding and questioning the way in which he was being positioned as an exhibit, if you like. Okay, so I guess I could have called the documentary, what I've been calling the documentary register, I could have called it the real or the literal, in the sense of a transparent medium of representation that draws the viewer or reader to concentrate directly on referential content. On the other hand, I could have called the performative aesthetic or figurative, which tends to foreground an art, or if you like, an artifice. But as I said, I want to suggest that in respect to an exhibition, as the production of social fields of sensibility, these two registers are constantly flowing over each other. So here I want to give a couple of examples, two quick examples. When in conversation, when talking to someone, we often tune in to what the other person is saying, to the referential content of what they are talking about, to the constative, as John Austin and other linguists would say. For Austin, the constative is about claims to the truth or falsity of a statement, whereby the performative has more to do with what you could call the suspension of disbelief, with what he in fact called being happy or unhappy, the terms he used, with what we could call emotional comportment, or if you like, emotional tuning. This is to say that when listening to someone speak, we engage our understanding in respect to how the speaker may be animated, speaking with a dull or excited pitch of voice, waving their arms around as they speak, or else subdued by the gravity of their tone. Another quick example I can mention relates to the two contenders for the upcoming elections in the United States, Obama and Romney. How they come to address their constituencies, supporters, their audiences, how they come, if you like, to exhibit themselves. I notice that very often they come out and they're not wearing a tie, they have their sleeves rolled up. And I thought that in terms of their message or what they have to say has also to do with how they perform. Sleeves rolled up, ready to work, moving amongst the people. So their message, I want to emphasize, is also designed to engage an emotional response, to extend and play up to the social and emotional fields locating their audience. Okay, so I move onto this photo, which I hope you have found interesting, comes from Lebanon, was taken in 2006, and indeed won the World Press Prize, or Photo Prize, I think it's called, for 2006. By a photojournalist called Spencer Platt. It was taken during, as I said, the summer war of 2006 when Israel was busy dropping bombs on the southern suburbs of Beirut. I found it interesting because you can see the clash or the contrast of foreground and background. No. The front of the picture is dominated by the colourful sports cards occupants looking rather trendy. No, rather trendy. And you can see that four of the occupants in the car wearing sunglasses, while the other one concentrates on her mobile phone. The young woman in the front looks almost as though she were posing, no, as though she'd seen the camera, just about to take a shot, so she perhaps, I'm not exactly sure really, sitting next to the driver as he concentrates on the road ahead. Behind them lies a mass of rubble, the twisted iron, broken glass, slabs of concrete that were obviously once a building. So there are five people in the background, three of which seem to be walking past, the other two talking on their phones over in this corner. And considering how there is the same number of people in the background as there is in the foreground, And I'm being a bit mischievous here because I actually found a sixth person in the background later and decided not to mention it, not to spoil my... but there is, which I haven't picked up before, you can see that sitting on a bike. But anyway, the same number of people in the background as there is in the foreground, one could say that the photo composes a unique symmetry, despite the rather glaring contrast. Consider also the gendered symmetry, or perhaps gendered asymmetry. Four women and a man in a sports car, and four men and a woman either walking past or lingering around the rubble in the background. Notice how the woman in the sports car have the confidence to look either directly at or in the direction of the camera, while the woman in the background seems to have averted her gaze. So the photo then seems to play on a number of stereotypes, which is to say that it plays up to predominating expectations of what a neighbourhood in Lebanon should look like. But my point concerns how the significance of the photograph emerges in respect to the particular ways in which it comes to engage an audience. In other words, the photograph looks at the viewer, sustains a field of social and emotional sensibility, exposing how Lebanon is conventionally and otherwise conceived. And this, incidentally, was probably not the aim of the photograph, but it tended to be the outcome of the photograph, regardless of what, as a world, as a press photo, I think there was a claim that the guy was there and just took the photo. No, but I would have problems with this sense of spontaneity, because even in spontaneity, he could have taken a lot of other photos spontaneously as well. No, and then there's the time lag of choosing this one to present. So, okay then, so the photo suggests both a divergence and convergence of documentary and performative registers, as though the sports car and its occupants were planted by the photographer against a rather somber, not so colourful background of the destroyed building and the passers-by. It raised a lot of controversy, both locally and internationally, some suggesting that it plays on a common stereotype of Lebanon as a contrast of cosmopolitan chic and war, destruction and poverty. Now, one particular caption added to the photograph on the internet that I looked up and saw, noticed that I quote, "The story behind the photo is more complex than appearances suggest." Now, I want to suggest that through its interplay or through this exchange of performative and documentary registers, the story could be understood to lie precisely in terms of its appearance, its showing forth. It's showing forth as an image extending into the field of its exhibition. So that what shows forth is precisely the passion of its public engagement. This is what comes to show forth through the controversy. So that regardless of the story behind the photograph, its constative, use this term again, register, its significance implicates a social sensibility, and quite a variable social sensibility. No, I don't want to singularize this. Emerges in respect to the expectations, the emotional and otherwise critical scope of its variable viewing. So, phenomenology. I want to talk a little bit about phenomenology. Phenomenology is a useful way of approaching this sense of what I was calling a showing forth. To think of the relationship between documentary and performative registers as an exchange of veiling and unveiling. the one showing forth as the other withdraws. I realize that that phenomenology is a difficult term, one of those many ologies whose disciplinary vigor for some turns into a pedagogic allergy. I was surprised to find that that the internet is full of sites with the title ology. It's not a site, ology. One of which declaring ology is all about passion. But anyway, rather than make a case of bracketing the life world, or else equating value and significance with intention, these two points, of course, related more to the work of Husserl. I want to mention Heidegger's more straightforward, if Heidegger's work can be regarded as straightforward. But anyway, his more straightforward notion of phenomenology, at least in his early work, as what he calls a showing forth, or unconcealment, Unverborgenheit, which is translated into unconcealment. I want to quote briefly from his Being and Time. Quote, "But what remains concealed in an exceptional sense, or what falls back and is covered up again, or shows itself only in a disguised way, is not this or that being, but rather the being of beings." Which leads him, end of quote, which leads him to declare with much passion performed through his use of italics here, that, and I quote again, ontology is possible only as phenomenology. Well, simply put, as dwelling, a theme he was to become preoccupied with in the 1950s, or as what we can also call inhabiting, what I've been calling inhabiting, what comes to show forth, what is presented through the exposure of a photograph, or else the curatorial momentum of an exhibition of artifacts, let us say, comes to inform what I've been calling fields of sensibility in which knowledge of the other is ontologically grounded and rendered worldly, anticipated, both documented and performed in respect to sites of cultural, social, and political habitation. Now, in the English language, we use the expression phenomenon or phenomena to describe usually someone or an event that stands out, that shows forth. We sometimes describe a person by saying, she is a phenomenon, or describe an event as, oh, that was phenomenal. Well, this is the expression used in the English language. What is phenomenal is what comes to be exposed. Grab our attention as something extraordinary, extraordinary, in excess of the ordinary. That in being exposed, as I think Heidegger wants us to consider, a phenomenon also implicates a background against which it shows itself, against which it shows forth. Here's another one of my exhibits, a photograph that I quite like by Robert Frank, from quite a famous series of photographs that he did in the mid-1950s, and it was subsequently called a collection of photographs called The Americans. What I found interesting in the photograph is how he inverts the documentary and performative. Here it is not the Hollywood star that appears, shows forth as a phenomenon, but indeed her adoring fans that have come into focus, while her image fades off into an anonymous blurring, because see, she's blurred, no? And it's the fans that are not a blurred background, but have come into focus. Now, his title for the image is Movie Premiere Hollywood. He doesn't name the star, but rather focuses his camera on how her stardom involves a social field of rapture and sensibility. And I was thinking here, you know, in those cartoons when the character is smashed over the head, and one way of indicating this person's being a bit ill-disposed is the stars going around the head. You know, it's interesting to think of it. But yes, rapture and sensibility. In other words, her stardom implicates a mode of emotional comportment. As the phenomenon of the star is constrained to withdraw herself, the documentary background, equally performative in its emotional rapture, comes to show forth, grab our attention. I guess for the camera, a star without adoring fans just wouldn't have any symbolic currency and commercial value. So that it would be accurate to say that a star's stardom lies in the social fields of its rapturous engagement. But the point here is that the documentary register has itself become the performative, something like those comedy shows that use canned laughter. You know, canned laughter as background noise to better let the humour show forth, stand out. Canned laughter, they record the laughter and it just plays on at different points. Which I think, myself, I sort of usually don't notice it. It doesn't stand out for me unless, you know. Now, earlier this year, when our colloquium was being proposed and discussed at ZMO, there was an exhibition and conference at the Haus der Kultur in der Welt. Called Animism, directed to some extent towards a critical reflection on ethnological practices. It explored how the gathering and institutional exhibition of non-Western artifacts worked to situate and habituate certain values and assumptions revolving around what the exhibition catalogue calls, and I will quote here, the border between animate and inanimate matter, or between pure subjects and pure objects, end of quote, with the purpose, the curatorial or remedial quest to question this border and purity. As the introduction, I want to read you a little bit from the introduction of the catalogue. It was a very good exhibition, worked really well. There were some great, and one of our colleagues, Regina, was also showing her work there. As the introduction in the catalogue says, and I quote, "Animism is not an exhibition about animism, which exhibits ethnographic objects in display cases which other cultures claim to be animate." So in saying animism is not an exhibition, talking about the exhibition itself, of course, not the practice of animism. "The Western idea of animism is the pre-modern other that falsely believes in the ensoulment of objects, which are in fact inanimate, is itself a symptomatic expression of modernity's basic assumptions." And to go on with the quote, sorry, a little bit more here, "The project Animism raises the necessity of a revision and decolonization, not just of the obsolete understanding of animism, but also of the modern imagination of which it is an expression." End of quote. In other words, animism says more about the West than about the other. You know, a bit like when you're talking to someone and they say something you're not particularly happy with, and in English at least, the response you can say, "Oh, look, well, that comment says more about you than it says about me." So the curatorial momentum of the exhibition was designed to induce an audience to critically reflect on how viewing itself participates in the production of knowledge and understanding of other cultures, in the process rendering exceptional a modernist trajectory that has apparently outgrown animistic practices. In other words, what comes to show forth is the scene of viewing, the looking at, and not merely what is looked at. Now, I picked up a few romantic overtones in the exhibition's rather feisty manifesto, one that imagines that animistic practices could be understood as, in their words, to quote again briefly, embracing other experiences, the praxis, extending beyond Western conceptions of life, soul, nature, supernatural forces or belief. All these last terms in inverted, qualified by inverted commas. Now I want to remove for the moment the qualifying inverted commas and point out that modernity itself, particularly the cherished form and practice of nationalism, to some extent relies on animistic practices, forms of animistic worship, if you like. And before I pick on Germany, I thought I would pick on my own country, Australia, and show you a few more images. This is the Australian coat of arms, embraced, as you can see, on the one side by an emu and on the other side a kangaroo, both, of course, being native to the landscape of Australia. You can see, of course, there Australia being once a British possession and the crown. But also these other two that I think are not native, at least not in terms of the way the emu and kangaroo are. And obviously the lion, of course, obviously refers to Britain, although the lion, I would say, is not so much native to Britain, I don't think. Unless in the zoos there it's been taken on a native thing. I don't know, but that's the English, that's a British reference. So totemic, I want to call them totemic figures, I would like to do, and suggest that they are not only imaginatively consumed, not only imaginatively consumed and digested, but these days can be ordered in many restaurants in Australia. Eat kangaroo or emu. I don't know if this is blasphemous or not, or whether it should be eating the totemic. But apparently, as my little bit of research on this, I found out that they are more popular amongst tourists, as it seems that Australians are a bit squeamish about eating them. And I won't now pause to unpack Australians. And in this respect, I was talking to Regina earlier today, and you had this interesting thing mentioning about this in Australia, though, which, if there's a chance, it'd be nice to hear about it later more. But I want to move on to another of my exhibits, to what we could call a totemic event on a grand scale, the wrapping of the Reichstag in Berlin of 1995. Before I do that, let us first recall that the term totem comes from the Ojibwa peoples of North America. It is pronounced ndudum and means something like clan, belonging to a group. There's a suggestion that it even means quite literally a relative of mine, with what has come to be associated with notions of identity and community. And if I was to be more rigorous here and do a bit of a digression, I would have to unpack, I think, the epistemic tenor of the terms identity and community, at least not just superimpose them in terms of how they are generally understood now and relate them to how Ndudum is understood currently and previously. But I won't go into that now. But the point is that a totem is invested with the symbolic force of communal integration. It does this mostly by animating the inanimate, which means, I guess, some ways that it is a practice of animism. So I have a few images of the Reichstag to show you, and I don't know if anyone here was actually around there at the time. I wish I was. It's absolutely to imagine. And as I found out, Christo and Jean-Claude, they had been planning this for 20 years. It's amazing that they've been planning this for 20 years. And I don't know, just waiting for the right political circumstances to suddenly do this. It's quite... and it's not their only wrapping. And with my research on this, I found out that they had also done one in Sydney as well, although I forget now what it was. The night scene, I think, and you can see at night just the people milling around there, quite an event here. I don't know if the artist himself signed that, but it looks like something someone took it through the windscreen of a car or something. But also lit up at night, and the way in which the lights played on this is quite lovely images, I have to say. Here's another image of the, and you can hear, see with the people down here, just the scale. But also another image here, of course, of both the exhibit and the field of sensibility, that's milling around it. There's another image there, here. Party mood, of course, it's not long before the balloon sellers and the hot dog carts and all that come around as well, add to the atmosphere. So, maybe I'll leave that one there. So it was built in 1894. I think it took 10 years or something to build. The building began in 1884, I think, 1882, I'm not sure now. Neo-Baroque style building, at least the architect Valo, I think, I can't remember his first name now, from more of the southern parts of Germany, was asked to, who won the tender, I think, for the building. Almost destroyed, as most of you probably know, on a number of occasions, but his basic structure and facade managed to endure. So upon unification or reunification, I'm not sure which, as the Bundestag moved back to Berlin, the artist was subsequently commissioned for their project. They used something like 100,000 square meters of polypropylene fabric to drape the building, with over 15,000 meters, 15 kilometers of rope of the same material to support the wrapping. But a stone was transformed into an undulating, floating surface. It may have seemed as though something inside was struggling to get out, suggesting a metamorphosis, an exposure to the outside world. Now, in the context of what I find interesting is how the Reichstag, as an exhibition, became a phenomenon. Paradoxically, its showing forth was achieved by hiding it, covering it over with white sheets. Through this exchange of veiling and unveiling, or this game of hide and seek, I want to ask not so much about what the Reichstag represents, although there is, of course, a lot of value in considering that as well. But for the moment, I don't want to ask so much about what the Reichstag represents, but rather how it was transformed into something that could be revealed. No? It was transformed into something that could be revealed. And further, how did the veiling, unveiling of the building constitute a site of revelation, implicate a certain vacancy or need, a desire for fulfillment, an emotional modality of self and social constitution? So as its documentary register was constrained to withdraw, its performative register worked to render a static, inanimate object available for emergent subjectifying orientations of anticipation, of that which seems to be suspended between the potential and actual, the animate and inanimate, the performative and documentary. Now, keeping in mind the Baroque influences on the style of the Reichstag's facade, I want to mention a book that was first published at the same time that the building was being constructed. The title of the book is Renaissance and Baroque by Heinrich Wölfflin, first published in German in 1888. In his study, Wölfflin adapts theories of art and psychology towards a consideration of architectural facade. He outlines an aesthetic he calls painterly style, malerischer Stil. In other places, he calls painterly disorder. He defines this as, in his words, an illusion of movement or the dissolution of the regular. End of quote. Baroque painterly style, he writes, again to quote him, a longer quote, does not convey a state of present happiness, but a feeling of anticipation, of something yet to come, of dissatisfaction and restlessness rather than fulfillment. We have no sense of release, but rather of having been drawn into the tension of an emotional condition. End of quote. This relates to an aesthetic practice in which what is revealed is always, in his words, partially hidden, so that the effect, again in his words, the effect is an impression of transitoriness. And I remind you here as well that there was at the time of the wrapping of the Reichstag, there was quite, at least I came to know in my research, an outcry calling for the artist to prolong the wrapping. And they turned around and would have none of this and said 2 weeks is 2 weeks. It was then done only for the 2 weeks. So to what extent does the Reichstag come to have consistency, to have substance, to consist of something stable? How is its narrative, or its various narratives, first interrupted and then augmented in this two-week scene in which its documentary or referential register was constrained to withdraw and hide itself? Beneath the billowing forms of its spectacle, its performative register. Towards unification, we could say, towards a political and cultural ethos, the Reichstag was presented, rendered present, significance rendered present, in two senses. First, its history, or its capacity to engage the force of history, was rendered significant and valuable for the present. Secondly, it was packaged as a present, gift-wrapped. But to conclude, my point is how its wrapping, its exhibition, situated a specific ethos in the midst of which its exposure, its curatorial or remedial effect, involved the production and engagement of a social and political modality of anticipation and emotional sensibility. Thanks.